Romans 9:11, many people have studied hard on this and have written much on this. So this will be just a kind of pathway that I have hacked through with the help of all these greater minds of exegetical scholarship, and yet I have to sift it all through to make it my own and to find a position. To stay within the limit, I will start with page 2. So you can read later the introduction. And I start with the purpose of divine election. Paul wants to apply the gospel truth he had unfolded systematically in Romans 1-8 to the situation of the churches at Rome. These communities consisted of both Jewish and Gentile Christians, but their unity was threatened by a spirit of rivalry and perhaps even anti-Judaism. Paul views the local problem in the light of God's eternal purpose to include Gentiles in his redemptive covenant with Abraham. Quote, so that he may have mercy on them all, Romans 11:32. The freedom of God's offer of mercy implies that God can also withhold it. Then he hardens whom he wants to harden. Even when he endures, quote, with much patience, vessels of wrath, unquote, because of their stubbornness and unrepentant hearts, according to Romans 9. When a person decides to resist God's will, God may choose to withhold his mercy, to, quote, show his wrath and to make his power known, Romans 9:22. God moves forward victoriously, whether in demonstrating his mercy or his judgment. Paul therefore makes God and not men central in his theology of election, and at the same time maintains the human responsibility to choose and to serve the electing God. Paul's use of the potter-clay analogy. Paul assumes a challenging question. He writes, then why does God still blame us? For who resists his will? He dismisses such a questioning of the Creator as improper, because it pulls God down to the level of man, who wants to rationally examine God's purposes. As Anders Nugrin argues in his commentary on Romans, man has no authority to call God to account. Paul appeals to the popular image of the Creator as a potter, who has the right to form any kind of vessel out of his clay for different uses within history. In the light of Jeremiah's conditional application to a nation, any nation, of the potter-clay analogy in Jeremiah 18, Paul also implies an appeal to Israel's response of faith to the message of imminent judgment on Israel. God's covenant requires reciprocity, particularly in the Messianic age. Israel is held responsible for its unbelief in the Messiah. If Israel repents, God will relent his wrath and in mercy reveal the riches of his glory. Walter Brueggemann aptly applies this covenant faithfulness of God and calls it Yahweh's responsive sovereignty. Moved with compassion for his kinsmen, the people of Israel, Paul wants to clarify the divine purpose of Israel's election in the present epoch of messianic fulfillment. See Romans 9:1-5. But questions arose about God's purpose with Israel, because so many Jews rejected their own Messiah. Has God's covenant with Israel ended, or is there a future for the chosen people? Have God's promises to Abraham to bless the nations, according to Genesis 12, failed to be realized? Paul denies that God's word or redemptive covenants have failed in Romans 9:6. He does not seek his rationale in the idea that God's promises are fulfilled spiritually in the church. While he does support this gospel fulfillment in the church, according to Galatians and Ephesians, it is not the complete answer for him. For Paul, the church has not simply replaced all Israel. The promise of God has not lost its validity for the Jews. In Romans 9, the apostle begins to build his case by differentiating between a spiritual and an exclusively natural Israel. Quote, "For not all who are descended from Israel are Israel, nor because they are his descendants are they all Abraham's children." Paul contests the popular view that physical descent determines the Israel of God, the seed of Abraham, as heirs of the promises of God. Paul discerns a believing Israel within the chosen nation of Israel, which Karl Barth has called the church hidden in Israel. Linking God's promise to Isaac instead of to Ishmael in Romans 9:7, Paul concludes, "In other words, it is not the natural children who are God's children, but it is the children of the promise who are regarded as Abraham's offspring." Verse 8. More compelling becomes Paul's argument regarding Rebekah's twins, Jacob and Esau. "The older will serve the younger." Romans 9:12. John Sanders infers, quote, "This does not mean Ishmael and Esau are damned, since the issue is not about individual salvation. Rather, Paul's point is that God chose to work through Isaac and Jacob for his redemptive project." End of quote. As the bearer of the promise, Israel is qualified by trusting faith, as Isaiah had defined it in Isaiah 10:20-22. The theological issue became the nature of responsive faith. Paul says that God did not spare the natural branches of Israel, and therefore shall not spare the natural members of the church either. Romans 11:21. The style of divine election remains structured by the principle not by works, but by him who calls. God's faithfulness is demonstrated in his redemptive act to preserve a faithful remnant of Israel. The apostolic church esteemed herself as God's chosen remnant people in the messianic time. Her primary task was to seek the lost sheep of Israel for Messiah Jesus. Paul's first answer to the question of God's faithfulness to his covenant with Israel was his remnant theology. He applies the remnant concept to the Christ-believing part of Israel in his own time. Quote Romans 11 verse 5, "So too at the present time there is a remnant chosen by grace." End quote. Through this remnant idea, Paul can at once maintain God's hardening of unbelieving Israel and his redemptive mission of Israel. He appeals to Isaiah's predictions of a faithful remnant that shall survive God's judgment on a rebellious Israel, Romans 9 and 10. Paul explains that Israel has stumbled over the God-given Messiah as over a stumbling stone in their pursuit of righteousness by works of the Torah, Romans 9:30-33. In Paul's judgment, Israel's mark of apostasy was not sin as the transgression of the law, but taking offense at the humble Messiah as if he was a rock of offense, and in Greek, petra scandalou, what gives offense or disapproval, in Romans 9:33. Paul points to Israel's responsibility to come to terms with the scandalum of a crucified and risen Messiah. How can this hardening in unbelief, this veil over their mind, be explained? Paul knows from his own experience as a zealous Pharisee how he had considered himself blameless with regard to the law, Philippians 3:6. In the same way, Israel